Nina, would the students from St. Mary's please stand so we can see you? Good morning and thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are with us under a national award-winning program called Court with Class. And this program is sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. And the students from all over the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. They're sent materials on this case, and if anyone wants to see some materials, they're outside in the foyer. And they may or may not have had lawyers appear before them and discuss this case. Also, as part of the Court with Class program, the students meet with a justice at noon and discuss the procedures of this court. The earlier argument, we had Little Chute High School and Catholic Central High School of Burlington. And they will join the students from St. Mary's Central, and they will hear Justice Sykes. They will meet with Justice Sykes. We've met you. I'll now introduce the court to you, and I'll start with Justice Sykes, who is on my far left. So the students should just stay here, and then she'll come out and talk with you. Seated next to Justice Sykes is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right is Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I'll now call our second case for this morning, 00-3548. Mark Vidal, or is it Vidal? Vidal, Vidal versus Lurk. And appearing on behalf of Mr. Vidal is Attorney Daniel L. Zitzer. Okay, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Daniel Zitzer appearing on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants Vidal and Torque, doing business as Buena Vista Berries and Commercial Union Insurance Company. Members of the court, the commission has argued in this case that common law certiorari is not a remedy available in this case because the workers' compensation laws are entirely statutory based. We don't dispute that the comp laws are entirely statutory based, but it's important for the commission and the court to also recognize that the administrative authority of the commission is also entirely based on the statutes. The principal issue before this court today is whether the courts of this state have the ability to ensure the commission's administrative acts are consistent with the authority granted by the legislature. In particular, the issue is whether the courts of the state have the ability to review decisions and orders of the commission that neither grant nor deny compensation to ensure whether the commission has acted within the authority granted by the legislature. Briefly, by way of background, a hearing was held in this workers' compensation case in March of 1998. The department's findings of fact and order were issued on October 2, 1998, and the applicant, William Gooden, filed a petition for review with the Labor and Industry Review Commission. This case essentially involves three orders of the commission. First, on March 5, 1999, the commission issued an order affirming the findings and order of the department. Neither party filed an action for judicial review at that time. Then, almost exactly 1 year later, on Friday afternoon, March 3, 2000, a petition to set aside the commission's order of March 5, 1999, sent by Mr. Gooden's attorney, was received by the commission by fax. On Monday, March 6, 2000, the commission issued what it characterized as a provisional set-aside order. And this order purported to set aside the order of March 5, 1999 on the basis of newly discovered evidence.
Why wasn't that timely, counsel, given the statutes that were cited but hardly referred to by the state.
I think it was not timely because it was not done within 1 year. According to case law that I cited in my brief, Your Honor. But I think more importantly is that action of the commission was not timely because it really didn't consider the evidence and set aside the prior order on the basis of newly discovered evidence. If you look at the language of that order of March 6, 2000, you'll see that the commission qualified the order by specifically reserving the right to reinstate its former decision if upon further consideration.
Well, I'm referring to specifically what the statute that the state cited in its brief on page 4 that says that the last day within which an act is to be done falls on a Sunday, the act may be done on the next day. Now, as I understand it, wouldn't this 1 year have run out on a Sunday? March 5th?
The 1 year would have run out on a Sunday, that's correct. There is some case law that I cited that I believe has never been overturned to the effect that if the period of time is more than 1 year, the deadline does not flip over to the next day. Rather, the act that has to be done has to be done within the period of time.
Okay, so thank you.
Now, granted, the statute was enacted after that case law was developed, but it was never specifically overturned. But I want to emphasize the fact that I think the more important argument we're making here today is what was done on March 6, 2000 really was not consistent with the requirements of the commission under 102.18 sub 4 sub c.
Sir, why can't you just go through any hearing that the commission sets up and then make your jurisdictional challenge? Why do you have to make it in a separate action bringing a writ of certiorari?
Well, Your Honor, in the Berg case, the Supreme Court held that really we don't have the right to do that. By the time that's done, by the time the case goes back for a further hearing, the issue about whether LURC had the authority to vacate its prior decision in the first place would become moot. And in the Berg case, the court specifically held that these issues are never reviewable under Section 10223, not at the time they're made because they're not orders that grant or deny compensation, nor are they reviewed subsequently down the road under 10223 sub 1.
Now, the Schneider case is to the contrary, but that predates the Bird case.
That's right. In the Schneider case, the suggestion was made that these orders would be subject to review after the next hearing was conducted and an order issued as a result of that hearing. But that language in the Schneider Fuel case...
First Wednesday. That is an alarm system that goes off on the first Wednesday of the month. So we are all assured that the alarm systems are working. So you may continue, counsel.
Thank you,
Mr. Zitzer. If I might just follow up, going back to the idea of judicial economy, shouldn't we perhaps go back to the Schneider case? Shouldn't we take the approach that the only sensible rule in a situation like this is to allow a challenge to jurisdiction once there's an order that could then be reviewed under the statute?
Well, I really think the issue is moot at that time. The proceedings have already been extended. The parties have had to go through the expense of defending and litigating additional claims and proceedings and perhaps appeals. So I think the issue is probably moot by that time, and that it's really too late to protect the interests of parties under those circumstances.
We have jurisdictional challenges all the time in cases as one of several issues that we're being asked to review. And I'm looking at this from a judicial economy point of view. Why should there be separate actions going on rather than one action where everything is taken up within the framework of that action?
Well, I think it's important for the court to recognize that according to the decision of the circuit court, we never would have the right to appeal this decision under Section 10223. Certainly, I think a situation in which we ultimately can raise the issue is better than one in which we can't at all. And the procedure set up in the Schneider Fuel case gives us the right to raise the issue at some point, it's better than what we have now under the circuit court's order and can't do it at all. I think, again, it's important to emphasize the nature of the Commission's actions under Section 102.18 sub 4. The Commission suggests that we really shouldn't pay attention to the orders and what happened under Section 102.18 sub 4 because the common law certiorari, the jurisdictional issue, is really what's important. But it's our position that you can't get to the jurisdictional issue in this case until you look at what the Commission did under Section 102.18, because that's where the jurisdictional issue can be found. And really what the Commission did in that order, the order of March 6, 2000, is that they said that they were setting aside the prior order on the basis of newly discovered evidence, but really, if newly discovered evidence didn't exist, then they would reinstate the initial order. And it's our position that what the Commission did by virtue of this provisional set-aside order was really nothing more than extend the deadline beyond the 1 year required under the statute.
Could I ask you a question here? 10223. That doesn't seem to give you authority to use that section for certiorari review, but does it preclude? Is there anything in the section that precludes you from doing that?
I don't think it precludes certiorari review at all in a case like this because the language of Section 10223 sub 1 is specifically tied to orders that grant or deny compensation. Here it's undisputed that we don't have an order that grants or denies compensation, so the limiting language found in Section 10223 I don't believe can be interpreted as precluding our right to resort to the extraordinary remedies such as common law certiorari in this case.
The Court of Appeals certification, if I recall correctly, goes through case law and concludes that that there is arguably conflicting case law and says that this case should be resolved by trying to reconcile arguably conflicting precedent and in view of policy considerations. That is, it said this resolution of this case turns on consideration of public policy together with reconciling conflicting precedent. So what are the policy considerations in favor of your argument?
Well, the most significant policy consideration is whether we as parties in this case or citizens in this state have the right to hold the Labor and Industry Review Commission to the authority granted to it by the legislature. In this case, I think we've got a very strong argument that what the commission did exceeded its jurisdictional authority under Section 102.18. And if if we can never raise that issue before a court for determination, I think that that our interests suffer significantly. And I think the issues of the public at the interests of the public at large suffer as well, because really the commission can act in this fashion, and according to the decision of the circuit court, nothing can ever be done about it at all. And that, I think, is the number one policy consideration. Other policy considerations that have been discussed in this case have to do with the prompt and speedy and fair resolution of workers' compensation cases. And I think it's important to point out in this case that on March 5, 1999, we did have a final order in this case. And if the interests of finality and judicial economy are really going to be served in this case, I think it makes sense for us to have the right to argue about whether the commission's decision to vacate that order more than 1 year later violated its authority under Section 102.18.
Finality, I suppose, cuts both ways, because if you don't have an opportunity to appeal it or have it reviewed, it's final for you.
That's right. And again, I want to point out there was an opportunity to appeal that case at that order at that time, but no appeal was taken at that time.
Yeah, I mean with regard to the March 6, 2000
act. I think I agree, Your Honor. You know, I think it's important to point out what we're not arguing in this case as much as it is to point out what we are arguing, and primarily that's because I looked at the Supreme Court's website and I read the blurb about our case, and I thought, you know, that's really not what this case is about, in my opinion. I think that it's important to point out that we're not arguing that common law certiorari would allow the courts to address the substantive aspects of the commission's order. For example, I don't think using common law certiorari, the courts could go back and look at the substance of the order and make a decision about whether or not newly discovered evidence sufficient to vacate the prior decision was really present in this case. I think what the courts can do under common law certiorari is take a look at what the commission did and make a decision about whether or not the commission had authority to do that or whether they did not have authority to do that. And we're really asking nothing more than that.
What's the difference between common law and statutory cert?
Well, I think the common law certiorari is, it comes from the common law, and statutory certiorari is found in the statutes.
I know.
I think we're...
That's fine, but substantively, what's the difference? Can you reach different issues in one and the other, or are they really the same?
Well, you may be able to. I think traditionally, common law certiorari only deals with the jurisdictional issues. I think that as the administrative law has grown up around the activities of certain administrative agencies, common law certiorari might have become more well-defined than that. But I think historically, it allows us to take a look at the jurisdictional activities of an agency and make a determination about whether or not the commission or whatever agency is involved is acting within its jurisdictional authority. I think
I'd like to follow up on that. If you interpret 102.23.1 as simply governing those situations in which there is an order awarding or denying compensation and not dealing with the kind of situation you talk about, then it would seem to me the prohibition of going under 227 or 8012 doesn't apply. But you've argued, I think, on common law certiorari, it's a very narrow focus. But if this 102.23 were to be interpreted to say you can go under 80102 if it isn't an order awarding or denying compensation, then that opens it up quite a bit, doesn't it?
Well, I think that again, you have to look at whether a jurisdictional issue is involved in order for there to be resort to common law certiorari. I think the St. Mary's Hospital case, which has been cited, is a good example. There, the issue was whether the commission should have quashed some subpoenas for the production of documents. In that case, the court held that there was no writ of certiorari available to address that issue because that was an issue that dealt with the conduct of hearings and was essentially an evidentiary matter. So I think that's a good example of a case in which common law certiorari would not apply because you don't have the jurisdictional issue like you do in this case.
Why couldn't the jurisdictional issue be reached in a statutory judicial review of the final order under 102.23, which provides that 1E, that one of the grounds, and they're very restricted, but one of the grounds for setting aside a commission's order is that the commission acted without or in excess of its powers.
Yes, I think that the Berg case has resolved that issue and has said that this kind of an order vacating a decision of the prior decision of the commission, is not appealable either at the time it's made or after another hearing and decision. So I think the Berg case stands for the proposition that there's no right of review of this order at all under Section 102.23.
Well, this gets to the question that Justice Crooks raised. Does that make any sense, given that it's explicitly one of the grounds for setting aside a commission order? The Berg case make any sense based on that? The statute explicitly authorizes a court to set aside an order of the commission on the grounds that it acted in excess of its powers. And your whole argument is here is that it didn't have the power to enter into this set-aside order because it was late.
That's right. But I think that the...
And therefore the subsequent decision awarding compensation was invalid.
I think the provisions of Section 102.23 are limited to orders that grant or deny compensation.
Can you have an order granting or denying compensation that is in excess of its powers? That's really the question I think you're being asked.
Right. I mean, any subsequent order awarding compensation here is going to flow from the set-aside order that you're objecting to.
Yes.
And the basis of your objection is that the commission had no power to enter into the set-aside order, and so any subsequent award of compensation is null and void. And so why couldn't that argument be made in the context of statutory judicial review of the ultimate award?
The only reason I think it can't be made is because, as I interpret the Berg case, it says you can't. It says you can't do that ever. And also, I think that...
And did that case cite this particular subsection that I'm referring to?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Well, it didn't even consider that argument.
I don't believe it did.
No. Let me pose the question. An employer under this statute has to have three or more employees. And I suppose if you had an employer who had one employee, it's not covered by the statute, and then there was an award given, then that would be in excess of the powers of the department here?
I think...
Do you have any idea what we're talking about?
I think I follow you, Your Honor. I think that you're talking... Well, I think, with due respect, I think the two of you are talking about slightly different things. I agree with you. I think an order which grants or denies compensation can involve a jurisdictional issue. Certainly it can. Section 10223, as Justice Sykes has pointed out, contains language that provides it. But this is not an order that grants or denies compensation, obviously. I think that it's a mistake to view this case as one of a series of cases in a continuum dealing with the issue of whether there is the authority to seek judicial review of a decision of the Commission setting aside a prior order. A number of cases have been cited by the Attorney General, but I don't think any of those issues strike that any of those cases clearly deal with the issue of whether common law certiorari is available as a remedy in a case which presents a significant jurisdictional issue. I would also like to point out in the Borgnes case, Justice Winslow specifically said that certiorari is always an available remedy if issues of jurisdiction are presented. And with that, I'll conclude my arguments right now. Save some time for rebuttal.
You have time for rebuttal, but thank you. I don't see or any other questions. Mr. Skoda, Assistant Attorney General representing the Labor and Industry Review Commission.
As the marshal had an opportunity, he has a... This is the day for charts from the Attorney General's office for the court.
Chart day.
All right.
Has Mr. Zitzer seen the chart? Okay. Do you have any objections to this chart? Okay. Can you have a grant, an award, or a denial of award that might be one that the Commission acted without or in excess of its powers?
Absolutely, Your Honor. But you want me to do the formal introduction first?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. Stephen M. Sabota, Assistant Attorney General. I'm representing the Labor and Industry Review Commission in this case, Your Honor. You can obviously have an order that grants or denies compensation that can be without or in excess of the authority of the Commission. That's one of the rubrics in compensation law, how an order like that would get set aside in circuit court. I want to, if I can, answer Justice Sykes' question first. The Berg case clearly did cite 10223. If you want to look for Berg, 236 Wisconsin 172, that particular language, the one that withdrew the language from Schneider Fuel, is at pages 179 and 180 of the Wisconsin reports. And both 10218 sub 3 and 10223 sub 1 are cited by the court.
What was it in Berg that led the court to say what it did?
I wish I knew, Your Honor.
I looked. I couldn't.
Right. That's the reason.
That's the briefs.
That's the reason I've given you the chart this morning, Your Honor, because it was very helpful to me when I looked at the continuum of cases on this issue in Wisconsin. If I can just very briefly go through that with you. In 1934, in the Seaman Body case, this court did an actual review on the merits of this newly discovered evidence issue, which I think is what Mr. Zitzer has already conceded. He didn't think a court had the power to do either under 10223 sub 1 or by certiorari. Well, it turns out we find out later that the reason why the court did that review in Seaman is nobody raised the issue and said, you can't do that. Okay, then in 1937, Schneider Fuel comes along, and as Justice Crooks points out, that they said, well, Seaman in 1934 was wrong. What we do is we wait until there's a final order granting or denying compensation. Then we have a review, and that review brings up all of the prior issues. That sounds good, and it sounds like a wonderful and reasonable rule that protects the rights of all parties, but it only lasts for 3 years, because in 1940, in the Berg case, they come along and kiss off Schneider Fuel as nothing but obiter dicta, and forget about that rule.
Well, now, if we fill in the blanks, since the court changes its mind often, this is an exhibit of that, I think, any more for any other reason, I would say that, just as Crook said this question, well, maybe we ought to think about Schneider Fuel again, because if we're looking at public policy or just plain fairness, that's the thing that struck me of what is involved in this case somewhat. We could go back to filling in the question mark blank and say, well, maybe we'll go back to Schneider Fuel. And, well, what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that, Your Honor, and I'm mad at Justice Crooks because he stole my thunder. Because this is basically the Commission's position, and I think you can understand that it's twofold. Number one, we take the so-called bright line rule position that we would stay that under Berg and the Meyer case in 1961, that this set-aside order is one of those rare, completely unreviewable administrative agency decisions. And that's the easy way to do it. That basically says to Mr. Zitzer, sorry, but you never get your day in court on that issue. And there's ample support for that proposition, I think, in Berg and Meyer. But the alternative argument and the one that Justice Crooks raises is, why not just go back, take the Schneider Fuel rule from 1937 and put that in the question mark box in 2002, and to me that's a perfectly legitimate, reasonable, and extremely workable rule. I think it's the rule not only in the civil area with regard to appeals of interlocutory orders, but the way I understand the law, Your Honors, it's the rule in all other areas of administrative law in the state of Wisconsin. This court has said that in a number of cases, one of which is cited in the commission brief, and that's the case of State versus WERC, 1974 decision, 65 Wis. 2nd, 624. And if I could just quote briefly, this is at page 637 of the Wisconsin Reports. Quote, if a proceeding of the nature involved here were allowed, administrative proceedings could be constantly interrupted and shifted back and forth between the agencies and the courts. While the employer is faced with a further hearing in this matter, to allow a proceeding of this nature would seriously hamper the efficient conduct of administrative proceedings, period. We think the better practice would be to have the examiner make a determination after hearing all of the testimony where he feels the issues cannot be separated, and then have that determination reviewed in its entirety if review is necessary.
What are you citing from there?
That's the case of State versus WERC, 65 Wis. 2nd, 624. And that, Your Honor, what I just read to you, I think is basically the Schneider rule. It's the same principle. In other words,
is there any other way other than what we're talking about here, i.e. overrule Berg and reinsert Sweden, is there any other way to prevent a renegade agency from exercising jurisdiction when it has no statutory authority to do so?
Can I answer that question in two ways, Your Honor? First of all, the commission wants to make it clear, and we thought we did from the commission decision and the commission brief, we say there is no lateness issue in this case at all. The one-year argument is basically a red herring. The commission entered the so-called provisional set-aside order on Monday, the 366th day, because they basically, I don't think, saw the order until Monday morning. And quite honestly, Your Honor, I thought I heard Mr. Zitzer say, well, if they wanted to act on Monday, they should have done the whole thing. In other words, ruled on the merits of the newly discovered evidence issue on Monday. Well, what about his right to respond to the petition, which apparently had been sent only to his client, the insurance company, and not Mr. Berger, the senior partner who handled this case? So I don't think it's fair to say that the commission, by doing what it did, was just buying time to have that second set-aside order come along clearly more than a year later.
What about the rest of my
question? Okay, the second part of it, a renegade agency, okay. Well, number one, I think the answer has to be, on behalf of my commission at least, they know the law, they're experienced in this area. If this petition had come in, let's say, on the 370th day to the commission, they're going to look at this and they're going to say, wow, the newly discovered evidence in this case is really great, but it's late. And I think given the presumption of regularity that you have to give to an administrative agency, they're not going to enter an order beyond the one-year period when it's clear they're too...
I'm sure your agency is just angel pure, but what about the one case in which an agency may choose, because they think that, for whatever reason, to exceed their jurisdiction? Is there any way other than adopting Schneider to prevent that?
Okay, can I ask you, you want to talk about agency law in general now, or just because we're contending workers' comp is a little world of our own, do you still want to talk about just the parameters of 102?
Speak about both.
Okay. Number one, administrative law in general, I think there's something called a writ of prohibition, which I think is still in existence in Wisconsin. And I think in the case you talk about, where the commission or the agency clearly acted beyond the statutory time period, you'd bring on a writ of prohibition and get a circuit court to order the agency not to proceed.
Why isn't that applicable here?
Because this isn't a writ of prohibition, number one. This is a summons and complaint that was artfully drafted with two causes of action, one under 10223 sub 1 and one under common law certiorari.
Well, why couldn't we just say that you can't do this under common law certiorari and let them bring a writ of prohibition?
Well, you could do that, but I think one more in keeping with the argument that Justice Crooks raises is, why not just say, look, Schneider fuel is really the rule, and what you need to do is go back and have your hearing. And who knows, at this hearing, what if they prevail on the merits? They don't have to worry about coming back. This is all speculation, you know, that they're going to get hit with a big award of compensation and are going to have to come back at all.
But Berg has been in existence for over 60 years. I mean, I would like to think that my previous former colleagues who sat on this bench knew what they were doing, and that there's a reason, and that even though we may not be able to discern that reason today, as soon as we adopt what it is you're urging us, something's going to come around and bite us.
I have an answer to that, Your Honor, and this is, again, pretty much speculation on my part, but I want to tell you that I think that when the Berg Court said Schneider Fuel was obiter dictum, they were dead wrong. Schneider Fuel was not obiter dictum at all. What that language was in Schneider Fuel was basically an elucidation as to how this procedure would work with regard to these intermediate orders. And it told parties in no uncertain terms, look, don't worry about the fact that you didn't take your circuit court review immediately and then you went through the hearing. That's not going to be held against you later by way of waiver. You get to raise all of those issues at the time of the final order. That was not opener dictum. That was, I think, clear guidance to the bench and bar about how to handle these cases. You know where the opener dictum came in, Your Honor, though, was in the Berg case. Because if you look at Berg, the argument that was raised specifically in Berg, and this is again at pages 178 through 180, they said that, well, when the commission had made its decision in Berg, they didn't review the entire record in the case. And I'm looking at page 179 of the Wisconsin Reports, and the Supreme Court says, well, wait a minute, there's a recitation right in the body of the commission order that says the commission, quote, reviewed the entire record, unquote. And the court said, well, if that's what they said, and taking that with the presumption of regularity, then they must have reviewed the entire record. And so if you go down that page, about two-thirds of the way down, there's a or a sentence that read, the findings and order made by Pottinger. I think that everything that the court said, beginning then on the pages 179 through 180, because then they started talking about, however, as is contended by respondents, and then they go on and knock out the language from Schneider Fuel. To me, that was all opener dictum. It's all the court had to do in Berg to dispose of the argument that was specifically raised by the appellants is say, the commission told us they reviewed the entire record, we believe them, the presumption of regularity controls, that's the end of the inquiry. And I have no idea, although they say it was contended by the respondents, why they needed to go in and knock out what I think was a very salutary and workable rule from Schneider Fuel. But I think Schneider Fuel was right. I think Berg was opener dictum. And I would ask this court as an alternative position that if you don't like, you know, the commission bright line rule, that you ought to return to the rule of Schneider Fuel.
What's your bright line rule? Absolutely no review.
The bright line rule is absolutely no review of this type of order.
Ever.
Right. It's the same as the compromise order described in the Meyer case, Your Honor, which is the 1961 decision. And I think you understand that when the department reviews a compromise settlement, which has been made by the parties, and basically says we've reviewed the compromise, it's fair and equitable, and we're not going to disturb it, the rule of the Meyer case said a court cannot second-guess that determination by the commission. That's a judgment call for the commission to make, and once they make it, we're not going to disturb that in circuit court because the policy of the law is to encourage compromise agreements.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your answer, either the question or the answer or both. Are you saying that the position of the commission is that there should never be an appeal, never a review of an alleged jurisdictional usurpation or violation?
No. The position, Your Honor, the way the commission brief is drafted, and I'm not going to equivocate that about it all, it takes what I call a hard-line approach, a bright-line rule, and it says the easiest way for this court to handle the case would be to affirm the ruling of Judge Ebert and say, this particular order is never reviewable in circuit court under Berg and Meyer.
Because that's the first. It's not an award or denial of the
correct.
Right. That's your bright line rule.
Exactly.
That's set forth in the brief.
And once you do that, Mr. Zitzer walks away and he's very unhappy because you've told him he can never get this order reviewed in circuit court.
Well, maybe.
But you,
maybe the order is unreviewable, but the jurisdictional argument can still be made. I mean, we're focusing so much on the nature of the order.
Well,
but he's not foreclosed from making the jurisdictional
argument. But in all fairness to Mr. Zitzer, Your Honor, he's got to say that because of what the holding of Berg is. He says that he recognizes that Schneider Fuel said what it says, but then he recognizes that 3 short years later, the court came along in Berg and absolutely withdrew that language.
Mr. Skoda, can I give you a hypothetical? Suppose Mr. Zitzer had a case before Lurk. I assume there's some kind of time frame in which decisions are to be made.
Correct, Your Honor.
What is the time frame?
Well, I'm sorry. It's not so much the Lurk decision. The initial decision by the ALJ is required to be made 90 days after the closing of the record. And then there's an appeal from the ALJ's decision to Lurk, and there really is no set statutory time.
Let's suppose Lurk gets the case on or about January 1st, 2000, and it is March, whatever it is today. They haven't acted yet. It's just sitting there.
On an appeal from the ALJ's decision?
Just sitting.
Okay.
And Mr. Zitzer communicates and says, when are we going to get a decision? And Lurk says, when do we get around to it? Do they have any remedy in court? There's no order here now.
Right.
Certainly there's not an order awarding or denying compensation. How do they get some action out of Lurk?
The way I understand the case law in Wisconsin on that issue, Your Honor, where there is no specific statutory provision requiring an agency to act within an amount of time, there is no review of that inaction by the agency. It's only where there is a specific statutory framework involved. And that...
Not March 2002... March 2006, they still have it. You're saying there's no relief?
That's my understanding of the law, Your Honor, and I would assume that if the legislature were to look at a body like the Labor and Industry Review Commission and find out that it was taking them 6 years to decide workers' comp cases in a system that's geared to speedy justice, my guess is that the legislature, in its wisdom, would install a specific statutory deadline on the commission the same way they've done for the ALJs.
Well, I see in 80102 that you have in your brief not only a writ of prohibition, but a writ of mandamus.
Right.
Why couldn't they seek a writ of mandamus?
Well, they could, but like I said, my understanding of the case law is that mere delay in reaching a decision by an administrative agency does not reach constitutional proportions. And that, you know, you can criticize an agency like that all you want and say that they should be acting much faster in these important cases, but I don't think you could get a court to, in effect, order the agency to reach the decision.
Counsel, I want to explore the ramifications of your fallback position. That is to go back to Schneider Fuel. I have not read the Meyer case.
Okay.
But I see in your chart it indicates that the Supreme Court upholds. Says intermediate orders are completely unreviewable.
Right.
Is it your position that if we go back to the Schneider Fuel case, that that means that the Meyer holding is also undermined?
No, because see, Meyer is specifically limited on its facts to the review of the compromise order, so there's never going to be, once the commission says, you know, the agreement. agreement is fair and equitable and the year period has expired, that's the end of that case.
Okay, that's my concern,
right.
Because as worded here, I saw it a bit broader, and I think of all the intermediate or interlocutory orders that are ordered by LIRC,
right.
And if those are currently unreviewable,
right.
Under Meyer and would be reviewable if we went back to Schneider, that's opening up a...
No. Going back to Schneider specifically focuses in on these so-called set-aside orders because it's basically put the proceeding in limbo before the agency, and what we have to wait until we get the order under 102.23(1) granting or denying compensation, and then whichever party feels aggrieved at that time can take the circuit court review, and that would be what Schneider says, that at that time, don't worry about waiver, don't worry about participating in the hearing. You go through the hearing, and then you raise all of the issues. They're all brought up on review of the final commission order.
I know that the briefs cite Larson, which is a workers' comp treatise, but I didn't have a chance to look at it. But several years ago when I did, the Davis Administrative Law book had a chapter on orders or actions or non-actions by administrative agencies that don't have a particular statutory review procedure. As best I remember the chapter, it's been a long time, the answer was sometimes they're reviewable anyway and sometimes not. I wondered if you're familiar with this kind of general administrative law and the general doctrines that apply.
Well, I think to the extent I am, Your Honor, I think it's fair to say that the general rule, I would say both in Davis and in Wisconsin, is that this court has told circuit courts to be very reluctant to interfere with the functioning of administrative agencies before the proceeding has run its course. And that's what I think the rubric is in this case. We're in the middle of this thing, and I know Mr. Zitzer's client doesn't like that. They would much rather have finalized the 1999 order. But quite frankly, Your Honor, you know, they're an insurance company doing business in the state of Wisconsin, and for them to go through the hearing, that's just part of the cost of doing business in the comp system. If you can't settle the case, you're going to have a hearing in it. And I don't think that's a tremendous hardship in this case for Mr. Zitzer to go through the hearing with Gooden and find out what the final result is. And that's what the workers' compensation system is all about, speedy justice. And it's not going to be speedy if we let people come into circuit court and start appealing these so-called intermediate orders. I think, like I said, the bright line rule is the easiest working rule. I understand it has some problems from a fairness due process standpoint. I have no problem at all with the Schneider fuel rule. I've talked specifically with the people at the commission about Schneider fuel, and they have no problem with its reinstatement.
I think maybe there's a third way here, the proverbial third way, and that is we stick with the rule that says no plenary judicial review of an interlocutory or intermediate set-aside order such as that which we have here, either directly or collaterally in the ultimate judicial review that might ensue of the Commission's ultimate decision awarding compensation or denying compensation. However, if the basis for attacking the intermediate order implicates the jurisdiction of the Commission, that argument can always be made in a subsequent judicial review of the ultimate decision of the Commission by virtue of 102.23(1)(e)(1), because that gives the court the authority to set aside a commission award if it exceeds the commission's power or jurisdiction. And doesn't that satisfy everybody?
Well, I understand what Your Honor is saying, and I totally agree with everything, but I really think that is the Schneider Fuel rule. Because, see, what's going to happen, let's assume the worst for Mr. Zitzer's side of the case, that the subsequent hearing produces an award of 100% permanent total disability for Gooden. And he gets an order from the commission that says that. He's going to go to circuit court, and he's going to have a complaint, and it's basically going to, and this is, again, assuming Schneider Fuel is the law, he's going to have a complaint, and one of his first grounds for review is the commission acted without or in excess of its powers under 10221, whatever it is, E, by entering an order when it didn't have the authority to do so.
No, I understand that, but yeah. The rule I'm proposing would not have allowed collateral attack of the intermediate order in Berg to have occurred in the subsequent judicial review, because that was a sufficiency of the evidence kind of an argument. He was saying that the commission didn't have sufficient evidence before it to enter into that intermediate set-aside order. That's not going to be reviewable under statutory review of the ultimate commission's order, because the ultimate commission's order and its findings of fact supplant the intermediate order.
Right.
So the result in Berg would have been the same. Right? We're not giving plenary review to these intermediate orders. We're giving the authority to have those jurisdictional arguments or similar arguments that are encompassed within the statutory judicial review to be made in the final.
Okay, now do I understand you correctly when you talk about that collateral review, that's basically going to the commission decision on the merits of the newly decided?
Right, because the commission's decision on the merits
is never reviewable. Okay. I think that's answered, isn't it, if you look at the chart again. Seaman Body, where they did the review on the merits because nobody raised it. Well, then in Schneider Fuel, they come along and said, wait a minute, there is no review of that intermediate, or of the newly discovered evidence, and said, that's not the law. So I think by your case decision in Schneider Fuel, that's already part of 10223, and I would be reluctant to tell the court to try and fashion a rule that would, in a nutshell, cover what you're saying. I think that's the rule already. I'd never heard Mr. Zitzer, in fact, I thought I heard a concession from him that say he knows he can never have a review on the merits as to whether Gooden, you know, produce newly discovered evidence. He realized that once the commission made that decision, he had to live by it.
And I wouldn't propose that we authorize such a review in the post-final order judicial review procedure under the statute.
Yeah, and I, if I understand, I think that's taken care of by what the Supreme Court said in Schneider Fuel when they discredited Seaman. I think that's the way it works out, and it's pretty arcane, and again, that's the reason why the chart was so helpful to me, because this is like a roller coaster ride when you go through these cases. The court, and I have a lot of respect for this court and the workers' comp area, but for some reason they really had trouble getting this issue right. And I really think they had it right in 1937 when they put the Schneider Fuel rule in.
How are the briefs on this? Did you check the briefs?
I'll tell you, I didn't check the briefs, Your Honor, and the reason why is because when we moved to our new building, all of Mort Levitin's briefs, which used to be right outside the hallway in the Lorraine, are now gone from the new Risser Justice Center.
Down on the second floor to the
okay.
law library.
Well, see, Sabota's too lazy to walk to the law library.
Take the elevator.
But the other thing, Your Honor, is I told the people in my office when we did a moot court on this case, I said, Mort Levitin was involved in the Seaman Body case. How in the world did he ever let the court do that review on the merits without screaming bloody murder? And I have no clue as to why that happened. I mean,
it might be interesting to check the briefs. He probably was on, well, at least through 1940, probably.
Right.
Counsel, do most of the appeals in workers' comp have that kind of language that we see in 10223? whatever it is, E1, that the commission acted without or in excess of its powers. I mean, my sense is that's not just, although it can be jurisdictional, it sounds jurisdictional, it's framed like this, that the commission acted without or in excess of its powers because it admitted evidence this way, or it acted in excess of its powers because it awarded too much money, and so that all the substantive arguments are really just thrown in under that language.
Right.
Is that the way it works?
Right. That's the general rubric, and this court has specifically held that a commission order that's unsupported by evidence in the record is a commission order made in excess of its powers, clearly.
Even though sub 3 deals with that.
Right. Yes, exactly.
So it's all subsumed under 1.
Right.
Okay.
And you very seldom see, well, fraud because of the commission, hopefully never, and then the other one very rarely used. So the one Justice Bradley refers to is clearly the most common ground in 102.23 cases. Thank you very much for the court's attention.
I just want one other question. Which does the commission prefer? The Freight Line Tough Rule or Schneider?
Are you asking the commission, which one the commission prefers or which one its counsel prefers, Your Honor?
Oh, well, I'll ask two questions. Which does the commission prefer and which does counsel prefer?
The commission tells me, Your Honor, that because the number of these cases is so extremely rare, they have no particular preference.
And counsel?
Counsel thinks that, in all fairness, the Schneider fuel rule is the better rule for the reasons that I stated, that it seems to be perfectly consistent with everything else in Wisconsin law, both civil and other areas of administrative law. And it certainly gives Mr. Zitzer, if he needs it eventually, his day in court on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Savoldi.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Zitzer, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Your Honor, I would have guessed that the commission would prefer the bright line rule myself. I think that without question, as the law stands right now, we do not have a right to seek review of these set-aside orders of the commission, now or later. And I think the question that is developing today is there any advantage to having review of these orders by common law certiorari as opposed to having this court reverse some of its prior decisions and reinstate the Schneider fuel rationale. And I think there may be. I think that using common law certiorari would provide an immediate right of review of these orders. And it would provide an immediate right of review of these orders that doesn't go to the substance of them, whether there was really newly discovered evidence. But it goes directly to the issue of whether the commission can do this in the first place. And it seems to me that there is some benefit in having that issue addressed immediately before the case goes back for further hearings and decisions.
You're making a judicial economy type argument. Is that it?
I think, you know, the judicial economy issue in this case has been raised by both sides, and I think that if common law certiorari is a remedy in this case, certainly I think that it's the most expeditious way of resolving this case. We could be done today, essentially, with it. Mr. Sabota has raised the issue about presumption of regularity, and in his brief he talks about the commission having a limited right to be in error when it decides workers' compensation cases and issues under the Workers' Compensation Act. And I certainly think that if the commission is going to effectively administer the workers' compensation laws of this state, they have to have the latitude to... It's a little unpalatable, but I think they do legitimately have to have the latitude to make some decisions that might be incorrect. But I think that an important distinction needs to be made, again, between the substantive decision and the jurisdictional decision. in this case, we have decisions made by the commission, well, really not decisions about their jurisdictional authority, but certainly they're interpreting and implementing that jurisdictional authority in a certain way. And I think that the legislature never intended to give the commission latitude to make errors with respect to its jurisdictional authority. And I think the common law certiorari remedy gives us the immediate opportunity to address significant allegations of jurisdictional excess by the commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zitzer, and thank you, Mr. Svoda, for an excellent argument this morning. And that concludes the hearing on 00-3548, Vidal versus Lurk.